Good afternoon.
May it please the court. Attorney Daniel W. Edwards betrayed both Donnell Carter and my client, Cheryl Armstrong, by representing both of them, and by not telling either Judge Spriggs or Judge Bayless about what he was doing. I don't know what he was thinking. I can't impute anything to him, but I do know that he didn't file E35C for my client, and he lost the 35C for Mr. Carter. I don't know if Mr. Carter knows about this conflict. I've certainly not told him. I don't know if anybody else has told him about it. And the conflict continues. Mr. Edwards is now a prosecutor in the Attorney General's office who is now prosecuting this case. And if I could quote from the Colorado Supreme Court, quote, "There is little doubt that public confidence in the legal profession would be undermined if lawyers were free to take part in both the prosecution and defense of a criminal case," end of quote. And that's from Osborne against District Court, 619 P. 2nd, page 41, pinpoint site 45, and that's the Colorado Supreme Court in 1980. And the Colorado Supreme Court quoted that again in People Against Shari in 2004, P. 3rd, 453.
And are you suggesting that the Attorney General should be disqualified from this case?
I don't have any way to ask it, but yes, I think that's correct.
Well, you could file a motion to that effect.
Well, there's no law that supports it.
Okay, then how is this portion of your argument relevant to the issues we have to decide?
Well, it's not actually relevant. Okay. What it's relevant to is the ethics of the situation. It's just a continuing ethical violation. And, you know, as I pointed out in Greece, you know, Mr. Edwards has done this before in a death penalty case. Against one of his own clients.
But how does that help us decide this case?
Well, because the issue is, when you have a conflict of interest, when you have a lawyer conflicted like this, you don't have a lawyer. And in this case, Ms. Armstrong would have never have known about this, never, ever, unless the United States Supreme Court had come out with a ruling against Florida. And when that happened, ADC and the Colorado Juvenile Justice Coalition asked me to write a brief for all the young people that got life sentences or virtual life sentences, and then these organizations distributed to all the kids that have these long sentences. And that's when Ms. Armstrong's family came to me just a couple days before the 1 year statute of limitations ran out, about 4.5 days, 5 days before. And I went to the district court and I saw this conflict immediately. But, you know, this was something that Mr. Edwards did. I don't know why he did it, maybe to make some money on it. You know, in that case, it would be even theft. But here, Ms. Armstrong didn't even get a 35C motion filed, and at this point, nobody has investigated her case. I spent most of that 4 days that I was on the case writing the 35C motion. I didn't have an investigator. I had no funds. Ms. Armstrong's family lives in a home without potable water. Okay, they have no money. And she never had a lawyer investigate the 35C, and we know that the district court judges thought that she had a right to have this lawyer, that there was something wrong with the cases. Judge Bayless appointed a lawyer. She filed a two-page motion asking for a lawyer to be appointed, and the presumption is when the judge appoints it, under Rule 35C, that the judge thinks that they might have some merit. And then Mr. Edwards got on the case and did nothing. And, you know, I was only on it for a few days, but I found the complicity error, which I think is very significant. The fact that Craig Silverman, a prosecutor who has eight published and unpublished Colorado Court of Appeals and Supreme Court cases finally committed prosecutorial misconduct, eight of them. And we have prosecutors telling the jurors that for complicity, all you have to do is know that the co-defendants are going to kill somebody. You just have to know.
Approximately 90 days lapsed between your filing your 35C and the hearing. Is that correct?
We never had a hearing.
And the issuance of the written ruling.
I don't remember exactly, but I'll take the word for that.
Did you make any effort to do further investigation during that time, and on the basis of that investigation, file a motion, a supplemental motion?
No, because I had no money to hire an investigator. I had no money. I do most of my work pro bono.
Yeah. Well, yeah, when I said investigate, I meant more thoroughly review the file, things you could do on your own.
No, because I have to do my other cases too. And no, I didn't do it. I'll agree with it. But because she had a right to court-appointed counsel to do this with court-appointed money, to have an investigator do the real thing, not to just abandon this woman to her fate.
Okay, so your point is that had your predecessor done what he had been appointed to do, he would have been able to bring to bear resources that you didn't have.
Many resources. ADC has no problems with spending tens of thousands of dollars on investigators. They will give you as much money as you possibly need for an investigator. But you cannot do a criminal case without an investigator. It just can't be done. That's the key fact in ineffective assistance of counsel. In almost every ineffective assistance of counsel case, the reason the lawyer was ineffective is because they didn't investigate.
Okay. Is the remedy that you want that we remand and direct the lower court to appoint a conflict-free counsel who then would use his or her judgment to do what you claim Mr. Armstrong did not do?
That's exactly correct. That's the only remedy we really want here. And plus, ADC now has been assigning social workers. They don't have enough. They haven't assigned to everybody yet, but they're going to try to assign social workers to every case for these three sentencing hearings. And here, you know, Ms. Armstrong falls in this gap. We have Rainier, who had 112 years in court. This court reversed and said he gets a sentencing hearing. And then we have Lucero, who had 84 years, and the court said he had a meaningful opportunity for parole. But what I'd like to see is Ms. Armstrong get a hearing to have present expert testimony, present lay witnesses to show her to show what she deserves for sentencing. Because, you know, as you look in this sentencing hearing, you know, Judge Martin says to the prosecutor, you know, why don't you just sit down? And the prosecutor says, if you're telling me you're going to give her the maximum of 96 years, then I'll sit down. And he goes, sit down, Mr. Silverman. That's not a meaningful opportunity for review. You know, and I know this is not part of the record, but I was a public defender for years in Denver, and I practiced in front of Judge Martin. That was my division, Judge Martin and Judge Fritz. And Judge Martin was a harsh man when it came to children that were direct file. He was a harsh sentencer, and everybody knew it. And
pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Carver.
Yes, sir.
I have two questions. The first one is, your comments to this point seem to have focused the investigator on the Graham issues. Is that your position?
No, I think there's so much more involved here, because an investigator should have been... They portrayed Cheryl Armstrong as a monster in this case. And an investigator could have really gone out and could have found other witnesses, could have found other children that she knew, could have found teachers, could have found social workers that are involved in her life, and could have shown to the jury, no, this girl isn't a monster. She's just a drug-addicted girl who's run away from home and has got all these teenage issues. And that takes away after deliberation. It takes away intent. Those are the types of things a good lawyer does in a trial. And unfortunately, Ms. Armstrong's family hired these lawyers. They were a lawyer who helped them buy a copying business that they lost later. I mean, not criminal defense lawyers. And with an investigator, you can do that. Now, you were a prosecutor for many years, Judge Bernard. You know that there's a huge difference in skills in lawyers. And the good lawyers are the ones that investigate. And that just didn't happen. And I know that there must be other legal issues involved, you know, investigative issues, but we just don't have them because we've never hired an investigator ever in this case, as far as I know. And for that reason, I'd ask this court to remand this case and order the district court to appoint counsel. It would have to be alternate defense counsel, and allow that lawyer to examine the issues and refile a real 35C issue based on the investigation. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. As to the first claim that there was a conflict with Dan Edwards and with me being able to prosecute this case on appeal, Mr. Carberry contacted Attorney Regulation. I spoke with them at length, and I received a copy of a letter from them, which was sent to Mr. Carberry, basically saying they didn't see any grounds for an investigation, so I do have that.
You don't need to spend more time on that.
Excuse me?
You don't need to spend more time on that one.
The trial court was asked to address whether the defendant's sentence violated Graham. The trial court ruled that it didn't violate Graham because, unlike the defendant in Graham, this defendant committed two homicide offenses, and she did not receive life without parole. So the trial court correctly resolved that issue. As to the issue about the timing, I think part of it here is Mr. Carberry saying he didn't have sufficient time to thoroughly to present all Ms. Armstrong's claims in his 35C motion.
Wasn't it a little broader than that, that he is attempting to contrast his position as coming in at the 11th hour and the 59th minute with little or no resources, as contrasted with Attorney Armstrong, who was appointed when he had not unlimited time, but certainly months, and could have obtained additional resources through ADC? I mean, isn't that an important difference if we're trying to level the playing field?
There's not enough information in the record, of course, about what first post-conviction counsel had.
Well, that's Armstrong, correct?
No, it's Daniel Edwards.
I apologize, I misspoke.
His first post-conviction counsel and what kind of resources he had. Those facts weren't developed on the record. And part of the reason why, and I think correctly so, is the trial court just gave Ms. Armstrong the benefit of the doubt and said, okay, just I will assume that first post-conviction counsel was ineffective, and I'll give you the only remedy you can get, which is I'll consider your post-conviction, your very untimely post-conviction claims on their merits.
All right, but that's where you're casting the issue differently than I say it. You're saying that the lower court gave Ms. Armstrong the only remedy it could, which was to waive the time bar. I'm suggesting that an alternative interpretation is the lower court could have leveled the playing field by rolling back the clock completely and saying, I will appoint you conflict-free counsel who can get investigative resources from ADC. I will give that conflict-free counsel a reasonable amount of time, certainly more than the 4.5 days that Mr. Carberry says, and we will go forward from that basis based on what conflict-free counsel chooses to do, not based on what Mr. Carberry put together in 4 days.
Well, I take issue with how much time he says he had to file the post-conviction motion. Under the federal limitations period, you have a year from when the Supreme Court comes out with a new constitutional decision to file for habeas. But the U.S. Supreme Court has to have also said that applies retroactively. And the U.S. Supreme Court has not said that Graham applies retroactively.
Isn't the present state of the law that's a majority rule among the lower federal courts and the state courts?
I know it's been split, but the U.S. Supreme Court itself has to say that. Last time I checked, the Tenth Circuit hasn't held that it applies retroactively. And so the time limitations period that he's looking at, I take issue with the way he's looking at it. And I also do know that if he had filed something in state court, a post-conviction motion in state court, that stops the clock right there. He could have attempted to supplement it. I don't believe he did, because the clock would have stopped then. But as it stands right now in federal habeas, that Miller or Graham decision coming out has not stopped the clock, because the U.S. Supreme Court has not yet said that it applies retroactively. So that 4.5 days or 5 days, he's saying he had to file that within, as soon as he filed a post-conviction motion, as soon as he did it, he could have supplemented it, the clock still stopped.
Okay, but what about the resource loading question? Mr. Carberry is saying that he did not have the same resources that Attorney Edwards would have had at his disposal had Attorney Edwards been conflict-free and done his job? Isn't that a difference that we, about which we should be concerned?
Well, first of all, I don't know that. It's not developed in the record. I don't know that he had the same resources or what resources were needed. It seems like a lot of these claims that he's saying should have been raised had to do with ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and of course these could be born from reading the record. I don't see any claims that he was saying that needed to be raised that would be something outside the record. Most of the claims he was talking about were things with jury instructions and failure to object and that kind of thing that could be gleaned from a reading of the record.
Thank you.
Does the court have any other questions about Graham or the sentence? Or?
Apparently not.
Thank you. I'd ask that the trial court's order be affirmed.
May I please the court? I'd like to address the last issue first, that you can learn ineffective assistance of counsel from reading the record. I do a lot of 35C cases. You can't. The key to ineffective assistance is the failure to investigate. And you can't learn if a lawyer has failed to investigate unless you do the investigation yourself. And that's just the way it works. The case that comes to mind is People Against Curran, which was a Colorado Court of Appeals case affirming a trial judge reversing a 35C in Adams County from a double homicide. Well, when that case went back to trial, Mr. Curran was found not guilty on both counts. And why? Because the trial lawyers really investigated and they found all kinds of witnesses who didn't testify at the first trial. And that's what the difference was. The Attorney General says about the timeline that the U.S. Supreme Court also has to find that Graham was retroactive. Well, that's not really the issue. You have to preserve the issue by filing the motion on time. You have to get the motion in on time. If you miss the deadline, it doesn't matter if it's retroactive because the federal courts are incredibly strict on deadlines. If you fail to hit your deadline, that's it. You're done.
And you're counting the days from the day Graham was announced?
The day that Graham was announced. 1 year from the day that Graham was announced. Had to have it filed, and I wasn't sure if I had to have it filed by the 16th or 17th. I wanted to get it in by the 16th because, you're never sure they're going to give you that last day because the Graham came out on the 17th. And then Judge Graham, that's the leveling the playing field. That's the issue. That's what we want. Just to remand, level the playing field, reappoint counsel just like Judge Bayless did originally, but this time a lawyer who actually cares, a lawyer who will go to AZ, get an investigator, and do his job. That's all we ask. And then also, as to the issue about Graham and committing homicide, I think this is a really important issue that I raised in my briefs. This is a matter of statutory construction. In Graham, they said they used the phrase, did not commit homicide. And the attorney generals and the prosecutors have argued that that means if you're convicted of a homicide offense, then you committed homicide. I have to disagree, and under the rules of statutory construction, under the rule of lenity, under United States against Santos, you can interpret that both ways. And cases like Cheryl Armstrong's complicity, we know she didn't kill anybody. She was convicted as a complicit. Or in cases like felony murder, where children are just convicted of felony murder, that's not commit homicide. That's being convicted of a homicide offense under a complicity theory, a different thing than actually committing a murder. Thank you.
Mr. Harper, excuse me, one question on the grand. But there's no evidence in the record at all that I could discern that she doesn't have a meaningful opportunity for parole. Can you comment on that?
Well, she won't be eligible for parole until 2037. We don't know anything, and here's the problem. All we are relying on are other people's hearings about life expectancy and things like that, and other people's hearings aren't due process. And the problem with other people's hearings is we know, for instance, in Guy Lucero's case, that his lawyers failed to put evidence into the record that every 20 years of being in prison reduces your life expectancy by 16 years. And this court refused to address it because the lawyers didn't get that in. And that's why she needs a hearing to present all these things. We don't know about her family conditions. We don't know if she has a history, for instance, of cancer in her family. We don't know anything about what her life expectancy is. And that's why she needs a hearing for this. will a real lawyer who wants to defend her and wants to put on the evidence that will defend her? Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.